Five, four, three, two.
Yeah, hey.
My next album will be called Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III.
It's part of the First Amendment. It shouldn't happen.
Exactly.
It's freedom of speech to be able to print what you want. And I believe thoroughly in freedom of speech, even if it's speech that makes people uncomfortable or it's stuff that cites the pot and stirs it. It makes us stronger as a society to let the 2% that are wackos out there talk about their conspiracy theories and all that.
I think China would disagree with you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Reverbs. This is the podcast number 2, the First Amendment Rocks edition. My name is John Anderson. I'm here in Lafayette, Colorado. Here with me is Tyler Mayo in, I believe, Berkeley, California. I want to get that right.
Correct. Greetings.
Also with us is John Kelly. Kelly, how are you?
Doing well. Hi, everyone.
And also Blake Mannion, also in Denver.
That's right. Hello, everybody. We're sitting here in Kettlehead Popcorn Soul South Studios. And yeah, beautiful cold evening. Tuesday, December 6th.
All right. Well, now that we got the product placement out of the way, let's go ahead and launch into the first segment. So today we are going to be focusing in on our new Attorney General, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, the current senator from Alabama. The Attorney General is really an important cabinet position because it is part of the inner cabinet, as they say. It is the, along with the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Treasury, they really have the core responsibilities of the U.S. federal government. So that should be fun with Mr. Sessions. A little background about him. He, as I said, currently serves as the senator from Alabama. He got his start in politics, also in the state of Alabama, as U.S. District Attorney for Southern Alabama from 81 to 93, which he tried an important case, the Albert Turner case, which we will come back to later. He was then elected the Attorney General of Alabama in 94, and then 2 years later elected to the U.S. Senate in 96. Where he has served up until his nomination by our new president-elect. Now, a couple quick hits about Mr. Sessions. He was the first cabinet pick for Mr. Trump. He was in the first batch of announcements, along with Reince Priebus, who is probably has the best name of the Republican Party, and Steve Bannon.
He might have the most villainous name.
He sounds like a Roman general.
Right.
So he led the, Jeff Sessions led the opposition to the 2013 Gang of Eight, a comprehensive immigration reform, which famously Marco Rubio was a part of, to his great detriment in the Republican Party primary this year. Now, Jeff Sessions has had myriad, shall we say, quotes concerning minorities that were not necessarily very PC. He also said that he rather liked the KKK until he found out that they smoked marijuana, which we will come back to later. Additionally, he opposes efforts to end mass incarceration. Apparently, he does not believe we have enough people in jail. He additionally prosecuted the Albert Turner case, which was a rather famous case. Albert Turner was registering black people to vote, and evidently Mr. Sessions felt that that was not a very good course of action. So he is going to have a lot of purview over a lot of different things that we really care about in the world. So
is this, I just want to ask a quick question, John. Sorry to interrupt, but Albert Turner, can you give me a little bit background on him? Was he with the Black Panthers? Was this where the whole voter fraud scandal thing came about?
No, so voter fraud is a fairly recent phenomenon, and it started back in, I think, 2010. It's been an effort to minimize voting for among groups that primarily vote Democratic. So, for example, you can vote in a lot of states. You can vote with a NRA card, but you, and please someone check me on this. You can vote with an NRA card, but you cannot vote with a student ID card. And so that is, you know, going after groups like students as opposed to gun owners. Now, Albert Turner was prosecuted by Jeff Sessions back in the 80s. He was signing up people in his community to register to vote, and Jeff Sessions went after him for voter fraud. Got
it. Yeah, yeah, I was just trying to give a little background on that.
And FYI, yes, it appears that at least as of 2012, some states like Texas and North Carolina let you vote with a, well, there was some weird music that came on when I was trying to check that link. Anyways, yes, it allowed, so for the editing purposes, yeah, it appears that at least up until 2011, 2012, I don't see anything else here that, yeah, in some states like Texas and North Carolina, you can vote with an NRA card, but not a student ID. Yeah.
So, Jeff Sessions, this is now, assuming he's going to be nominated, he's going to be our attorney general, and going forward, he is going to be our chief law enforcement officer. So, Kelly, excuse me, what do we, how do we feel about this? Like, what do you think we can do, going forward into 2018, 2020, how do we protect voting rights? What are the best courses of action?
Okay, so best courses of actions to start out with are really on-the-ground responses to anything that takes away from the Voting Rights Act of 1964. There's states throughout the country that have cut voting rights, especially for African-American communities. And I'm not sure that Jeff Sessions as Attorney General would do anything to stop this from continuing to happen. You know, he has famously came out and said, especially during his court hearings in 1984, when he was going to be appointed to federal court, and they dismissed his candidacy for saying stuff like the ACLU was communist inspired and un-American, which is an interesting.
Didn't somebody say he was too racist? Do I have the right guy?
Yeah, John said that. But I think, but it goes back to that fact that he was never confirmed to federal court in the 80s under Reagan. I mean, I think that it's a lot of local stuff that is the main problems with abuses against the Voting Rights Act. And certainly with Sessions' stance on a lot of that type of, I guess, harsher requirements for people to vote, higher levels for them to jump over to be able to vote. I don't see him stopping any states from imposing harsher realities on voters.
Right. I think that's important to note in this discussion, especially in this current climate of fake news, which we will discuss later on in the podcast. But the states run elections, right? Like, the federal government does not run elections. America actually has a bajillion different ways of that we run elections. So it's basically impossible to rig a United States election, federal election. And the United States Attorney General has a role in supporting states and localities in elections. Now, Obama and his Attorney General and Justice Department was aggressive in supporting states, supporting civil rights. But that's probably, Jeff Sessions is definitely not going to be supporting this. This is going to be a pretty negative consequence. Mm-hmm. And another negative consequence will be he doesn't seem to think that we have enough people in jail. So, Tyler, this seems pretty scary, right? Like, we have a bajillion people in jail. It doesn't seem like punishment works. or fixes people, but we're about to double down on that. How do we feel about it?
Well, I don't feel very good about it. I mean, you know, already, yeah, I mean, already mass incarceration is a huge problem. And, you know, in the show notes have some resources here. But, you know, we can see through various steps in history how slavery became mass incarceration. Yeah, and specifically in the African American or Black community. Yeah. So there is like, you can see by the passage of certain laws, we won't get into it now, that's what the resource will be, you can look into just how, and like the construction of certain mass incarceration systems, how it's a very clear progression from slavery into mass incarceration, right? We have the most percentage of our population in prison in like, I think, I mean, the entire developing world, I think it's the world. I mean, it's definitely higher than China. It's definitely, I think it's the entire world.
It is. And I think a good example of what you're talking about, Tyler, is the sentencing disparities between crack and cocaine, right?
Exactly. Yep. Things like that. Things like, so there's so many things. That's one aspect, right, is crack was heavily, heavily penalized in, whereas cocaine is, I think, Schedule 2, right? And it's fucking the same active properties. So, how does that work out? Well, the communities who use these drugs are very different, right? Crack is used in the poor, often Black communities, and cocaine is used by rich white people mostly, you know? And so that's one perfect example. Another one is, just certain laws that target poor communities, which then of course tend to have more minorities. So for example, like the broken windows policy in New York City, that's a good example where...
Can I get an explanation of that?
The broken windows policy was basically, this was under, I think it was under, was it under Bloomberg? I think maybe. Which
was it, Giuliani?
I mean, I always go with Giuliani, but I think it was actually, I think it was maybe on the books though under Bloomberg. Maybe I don't remember exactly, but I think he did try to. Anyways, point is what it is it's like in the like why it's called broken windows. It's basically like, you know, if you let a few windows be broken, then eventually the whole house will become decrepit. That's like the metaphor. So it's basically like making sure and enforcing small laws. Like really minor infringements, that, and the idea there being that like then in that way you'll like you, it won't lead to larger infringements, which is really dumb logic to begin with, but it's like that's why you have cases of like Black men being choked for selling cigarettes, right? Or like that's the culture behind it, is that you target small offenses, which obviously,
so if you give an inch, they'll take a mile.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that obviously just targets like poor communities where people are trying to scrape by. Mostly
marijuana is a gateway drug, right? So it only makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. You got that ideology. Yeah.
I'm just kidding. That was a joke.
Yeah.
I think it's super concerning, John, because I just looked up an interesting little stat here. Police arrested someone for weed possession every 51 seconds in 2014. And you know, some states here in the United States are trying to legalize and or decriminalize marijuana and make it available for medicinal use, and it's a huge conflict of interest having somebody like Jeff Sessions as our attorney general come in, who has this quote saying that he used to like the KKK until he found out they all smoked pot, you know? So it's like,
right. So we had a really interesting dichotomy this election in that marijuana and Donald Trump were both really big winners. And Jeff Sessions, as you just said, seems to think that the only thing wrong with the KKK is that they're high. So
I'm unfamiliar with Trump's standpoint on marijuana personally. What has he said?
So, like every other position he's ever taken in his life, it essentially sums to zero.
Okay, that's what I kind of wanted to assume that, but I thought I'd ask too.
I think like Wood gives a little bit of an indication. He's nominated Jeff Sessions to oversee marijuana policy, and the only reason like states like Colorado have been able to develop a retail market unharassed is that Eric Holder and Barack Obama decided that they would let them, and the federal government can decide to not let them do it if they want to. So that should be pretty interesting. So as far as Trump goes, personally, my understanding is he's never had a drink in his life. So that is amazing. But my understanding is he's a very sober Sally.
It's the people without vices that we should all be concerned about, right?
Yeah, I mean, typically the more obvious your vice is, the less creepy it is, right? So we're facing an interesting set here of issues, right, with Jeff Sessions. Another one is immigration, right? He is a huge proponent of building that wall and deporting millions of Americans. So, Blake, what do you think? Like, how is he going to pay for that wall?
Mm-hmm. I think,
I don't know exactly how they would be able to to pay for this wall once people found out where the money was going to come. Once money, right? another interesting little piece of information I heard recently was back in September 11th, 2001, we closed down the borders to Mexico and Canada for a little while after that terrorist attack, right? And can't remember the factory. I want to say it may have been like Ford, vehicle factory. They were closed in a week after that because they could not get their parts across the border from Mexico. So they had to start closing down the factory to produce these cars. My thoughts on Mexico and immigration, or I guess immigration in general, not just Mexico, because that goes beyond that, but I don't see how we could really establish a Muslim registry. I don't see how we could build a wall. A lot of this just sounds like a bunch of big talk to me, and I think that there's going to be a lot of push against those ideas once they actually start to come to fruition.
I think it's pretty important that I've been reading about how to deal with totalitarians, and I think it's important that we take them seriously.
No doubt.
And I think that Trump has proven time and again that we should take him seriously. And we have precedent in this country under Eisenhower, who I consider to be a fairly good president. We launched something called Operation Wetback, which is a real thing. And we deported a ton of Mexicans.
Sure.
And in World War II, within recent memory, living memory, we put millions of Japanese people in internment camps. So there is absolutely precedent for this, and we should take him seriously.
I'm not saying we shouldn't take him seriously. I'm saying we should wait and see what exactly he is going to try and do first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have to fight the one that they're putting forward, right? But we have to resist all of them, you know, at every turn. But I likely will prioritize one, whichever one they think it will be the easiest accepted by the, by the American people. You know, they'll be like, all right, which one are people going to mostly like support?
So what,
right?
Is that, or deportation? You know, what would that be?
I mean, who fucking
Muslim registry?
I mean, it's so hard. I mean, all these ideas seem so outlandish and nuts to me that it's kind of hard for me to say which. But I mean, people.
By the way, everybody register for a Muslim registry if that's a thing.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah, it's like, where do you start? If I mean, like, what's going to happen first? Okay, when that happens. Okay, then take it from there. John, what do you propose? Anderson.
Well, I think it's... First, it is important that we begin mobilizing as quickly as possible. I mean, that is what this podcast is. That is what Flood the Gov is, right? And I've been heartened by most of the liberals that I know have become politically mobilized, which I am really hopeful about. I think the first thing that we can do, because we don't know exactly what Trump is going to do, he has proven to absolutely be unpredictable. So I think we need to plant our flag in terms of values. I am for... The thing that makes America exceptional is that we all get to be an American, no matter what your creed, no matter where you were born, no matter how you were born, you get to be an American. And that is where we plant our flag and respond as forcefully as possible to whatever comes at us that threatens those values. But I think right now, kind of in the calm before the storm, we have to plant our flag there.
And I mean, in some ways, that's kind of what we're doing with this podcast, right? We're trying to establish ourselves and our values. Prepare for the war that's to come.
Which, that happens to be a pretty good segue to our next segment.
Can I say one more thing just real quickly before we move on? So just in that vein of sort of, and I'm going to now, in this moment, sacrifice any attempt to not be come off as a commie leftist. And and just want to say that Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, which, by the way, his name sounds like the basement tapes of like a like new age shitty jazz artist. like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, Sessions the Third by Jefferson Beauregard. but what he is, I mean, what he is, if you look at the policies, you look at like, you know, this history here, I mean, he is a white supremacist, you know, like he is, he supports all of the shit, like his actions show that he is a white, like, he's on immigration, like his basic support or at least indifference to the KKK, opposing efforts to end mass incarceration. Like we talked about, that's a continuation of slavery. Like all of these things, like, yeah, going after Albert Turner for helping black people register to vote. All of these things are ways to disenfranchise black people, and that's what white supremacy is. So that's all I have.
Yeah, I think that's another thing in the interim before, you know, before we know exactly what's going to happen. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's probably a duck, right? And he is a white supremacist. I think it's important that we say that out loud.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess because we have abandoned all facade of not being commies, we're going to spend the next four or five weeks on the First Amendment. It's awesome because they put it first.
Number one.
So a little bit of background on the First Amendment. We ratified the Constitution without the Bill of Rights. There were a group of people named the Anti-Federalists because they were bad at branding back then. And they were upset about not having a Bill of Rights. So in exchange for supporting the Constitution, they made a deal to pass the Bill of Rights in the first legislative session once the Constitution was ratified. They ended up doing this because they kept deals back then. Now, importantly, the First Amendment laid out five very specific freedoms which the U.S. holds really dear. These freedoms are religion, speech, press, the right to assemble, and the right to petition your government. So because we are thorough and rigorous, we always go to our text. Now, the text of the First Amendment is Amendment 1, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So today we have decided that we are going to first tackle the freedom of the press. This is mostly based off of urgency since, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell, but it seems like this might be one of the things that Trump comes after first. He has threatened journalists with, quote, opening up the libel laws, whatever that means. He singles out journalists by name at rallies, which seems to be some version of chilling and intimidation. But I think it's important we do a really quick history of journalism in the United States. Journalism really came into its own during the Revolution, mostly in pamphlets specifically. Think about Common Sense by Thomas Paine or Federalist Paper by my man Hamilton and Madison. And don't forget John Day. He had five. Now, moving right along, the journalism became pretty partisan pretty quickly. In America, there's a really wonderful podcast by John Dickerson of ABC called Whistle Stop. He has a great episode on James Callender. I would really, really recommend it. If I remember correctly, Hamilton and Jefferson both hired him as his newspaper guy, and he was a rather terrible, wretched human being. And if I remember correctly, he ended up dying drunk in 6 inches of water. But make sure you listen to the episode. I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. The first independent newspaper was the New York Herald, started in 1835. The New York Times, or the Gray Lady, was also founded in 1851. This was moving away from James Callender partisan-like newspapers. And then we moved into the period of yellow journalism, which is basically clickbait for 1891. It was totally sensationalized and not based on facts.
Hold on real quick. Just to clarify for the listeners, yellow journalism was sensationalism.
Yes. Yep. Okay. And that was pre-progressive era. Think after the Civil War and before Teddy Roosevelt or so. And then we moved into the era, the progressive era, with muckraking, which is now investigative journalism, and the professionalization of journalism, like university journalism schools like U of Miss or Columbia. Then we got into big broadcast journalism, think the big three networks and Walter Cronkite, people like that. Then we moved into cable news, think Crossfire, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. Interestingly, I think the big first event for CNN was Tiananmen Square. Then we moved into the internet era with mass media sharing and what we're in today with social media. No real gatekeepers, satire as truth tellers with John Oliver, people like that. We have balkanized journalism, which means that we pretty much all just hang out in our camps, right? Like, we have a Breitbart camp, and then we have a Mother Jones camp, and they like to talk to each other, but they do not talk to each other. They don't talk between each other. So this is a pretty big problem, right? Now, on top of that, we have an administration that has been pretty hostile to the First Amendment, which the founders seem to be pretty important. That's why they put it first. So I think it's pretty important for a couple different reasons. Now, Kelly, do you have any pillars of journalism that you'd like to talk about that seem to be pretty important? Why are we talking about this?
Pillars of journalism, yeah. Interesting. I think you did a pretty good job covering everything from a historic point of view. It's obviously a very quick overview. There's a lot of stuff that happened. But I think right now we are square in the middle of kind of the internet taking over media and how people view media, right? Two-thirds of people in the United States get a majority of their news from Facebook and from their Facebook feed. We no longer follow the classic media, almost gatekeepers, right, that present information hopefully on an unbiased account, but sometimes it is biased to the masses. And I think if you look at it from a historical perspective, there's with each new type of technology and each new push forward by a new media form, there's certain reactions and there are certain triggers of the way people react to it. So like think about in the 1970s with Vietnam is the first time that war footage was ever put on television, right? And there's footage of actual war going on major networks, which helped spur anti-war movements and peace movements. So it'll be interesting to see over the next, who knows how many years, I mean, the internet's not going anywhere, but certainly now we're in a very, very biased and divided media scene. Like you were saying, John, the Breitbart people don't talk to the Mother Jones people. And a lot of the times, the circles that people stay in as far as following media reinforces their worldviews and reinforces their own biases and their hatred for the other side. But on the other hand, it's actually, to bring it back to the First Amendment, it's everybody's right to write whatever they want on the internet, right? That's where the freedom of press really comes in, and that's where it's debatable, because you can't really stop it. So how do we deal as a society with these kind of sensationalist journalists that can blog about anything at any time, and information can get to people in a blink of an eye without somebody going, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't be posting something like that so quickly. I think it's important to note for the First Amendment argument that it's absolutely people's rights to post this stuff. But how do we deal with it with the large amount of information?
Yeah, I think you've hit on a really interesting tension of values there, right? And Blake, I'd like you to chime in on this. I think it's really interesting that, so democracy's good, right? Like, we can all agree on that.
I think we all agree with that.
Right. So we've seen the democratization of journalism, right? Everybody's a journalist, right? And we think of that as being ultimately a good thing. That the more people that are participating, the better.
Right.
But we've seen
Facebook
also
live.
That
you can broadcast
the truth
any
is hard,
event,
right? Like it is a difficult thing to achieve and understand, and it takes a lot of contextualization and research. And so when you have everybody posting willy nilly on Facebook, it becomes a really big problem because to make good decisions as a citizen, you have to be able to know the truth. And the democratization of journalism makes finding the truth harder. And so that actually exposes kind of like a tragic flaw in democracy.
Right. And journalists, scholars that study journalism call that the tyranny of the outraged, right? There's small minority of people, but they speak the loudest and they post the most about it. So
right, like I think gun rights is actually a really good example of that, right? Like how many people are in favor of background checks? Like 92%. I'm pretty sure that's a real number. But we can't pass the bill. But I mean, like when I was working down at the state, we passed the gun bills after Aurora in 2011 in Colorado, and we had those humongous Dodge trucks with humongous smokestacks and humongous don't tread on me flags going around the Capitol building, going around and around and around the Capitol building from 8 to 5 p.m. And you don't see that happening on the other side of the equation. That 8% ends up being louder than that 92%, which ends up being a tragedy. But I want to get back to this tension of values, Blake. What do we think about the fact that the democratization of journalism might not be a good thing.
Right.
Like, how do we resolve that tension?
It's almost like it needs some checks and balances, huh? Well, it's interesting because, so I have here a quote from Trump during the fifth Republican debate. He said he would be open to closing parts of the internet to prevent ISIS from attracting recruits. He claimed that ISIS is using the internet. Okay, so he said, ISIS is using the internet better than we are. And we created it. That's what he said. So it, with this statement and other statements that he said throughout, you know, his campaign and since he's, not so much since he has been elected, but, you know, he mentioned that he wanted to filter the internet. And it's like, how do you do that? You know, we can do it the way that like China does, but then there's, you know, freedom of speech issues, filtration, you know, it's like, is that the right thing to do? However, then you come across this issue with like satirical media and people totally poisoning the well of good information, you know, and it's like, well, where is the happy medium? It's almost like Trump is sensitive to that, although he was using ISIS as kind of like the launch pad, but you can almost tell as well that he would like to filter some things that come out of like, you know, every other source of media.
You know, this reminds me of this interview of Malcolm Gladwell that I was listening to.
Oh yeah, Tipping Point.
And I would recommend his podcast. It was pretty good recently. But and he wrote Outliers, and I think this was on Ezra Klein's podcast or maybe Longform. But the question was, what in 50 years will people look back on and think like, what the hell was that? And he was like, oh, the internet. People look back and be like, what the hell was that? Because actually, it was relatively the same point Trump was making. Right. The internet is so insanely insecure that it is crazy that we do things like banking. And so it's just crazy that we do all of this on the internet.
Checks and balances. What is a check and a balance, right? It's kind of like this thing. So like in coding, John Anderson, you've been taking some coding, and you know you've got like only so much you can do and work with, and then you set up these perimeters, and you have to work within those boundaries, you know. And if you type something wrong, it messes up the whole program, you know. So checks and balances, let's say for the president, for any position in office, they're to ensure that you're doing what's best, that you don't operate uncontrollably, inconceivably, inappropriately, immorally, I think. Oh, immorally. Oh, that's interesting. Let's talk about that. I think checks and balances are supposed to be, like, they should reside within everybody in form of, like, morals. And the issue is that I don't think as many people have this internal check and balance like them to have. And
I'm going to stop you there a bit there, Blake, because I'm not sure exactly where you're going, but I think I get where you're going. I totally disagree. You can't legislate morality. I don't think there's any way to.
No, you can't. You can't. You can't.
If you're thinking about it in terms of checking the media through systems of check and balances, you're thinking about having to create some kind of overseeing agency or committee or something that then can put checks and balances through the media.
It's not going to happen, right?
It shouldn't. It's part of the First Amendment. It shouldn't happen.
Exactly.
It's a freedom of speech to be able to print what you want. And I believe thoroughly in freedom of speech, even if it's speech that makes people uncomfortable or it's stuff that cites the pot and stirs it. It makes us stronger as a society to let the 2% that are wackos out there talk about their conspiracy theories and all that. And
I think China would disagree with you. But,
yeah, well, I don't agree with China's media policies and their choices of personal freedoms.
No, I'm not suggesting. I'm not suggesting that we establish a system that does that. I'm trying to bring about the reasons why we created a checks and balance system. It was so that we could check ourselves and not lose sight of what is right and what is wrong.
And I think that what's interesting right now is you have no checks and balances, totally no filters, everything's open, especially when it comes to like internet and media. And this is new for us, you know. We are one of the first generations to really experience this. And we have things to think about, and we have room to grow. I'm not saying we need to filter and apply a system, say, like communist China, so that people can't obtain information and put out certain information. I'm just saying it's unfortunate that we as a society don't have that own internal balancing system within ourselves to make those right decisions. And if we were to tackle this problem, I think that's where we should look.
Kelly, I agree with you that you cannot legislate morality. But Blake, I also agree with you that we need checks and balances on our sources of information. And I think freedom of speech is important, but we cannot legislate that check. That check should be each other, right? Barack Obama said the most important office in America is the office of citizen. And I think that there's a ton of wisdom in that. And like, I'm against term limits, right? Because citizens need to be checking their politicians. And the election is the term limit. And we need to be fulfilling our responsibilities as a citizen. And that's how you get around the legislating morality problem. You can't make it a law, but you could damn well advocate.
Yeah.
And so, Tyler, speaking of advocating, how do we advocate around journalism?
Well, there are many great publications that you can support. I'm not going to name them.
I donated to Wikipedia tonight.
Hey, good work. Good work. Whatever you support, whatever the news places that you go to, find your way to support them, whether it's like actually like subscribing, right, to their, if it's online subscribing, or donating money if it's something like Wikipedia, the nonprofit, or getting the newspaper, or now most print journalism also has some sort of online registration. Help them stay up and running. Like, such a large amount of all journalism cites print media that, like, print media is just super essential. And there's also great other like activist organizations like the Center for Media Justice is really incredible. They do some incredible advocacy work, like making sure that like they were really big in the push behind net neutrality. They stopped the Comcast Time Warner Cable merger. They're like a great advocacy group. So there's lots of organizations like that. But I think also at the same time, like you're saying, like we have a responsibility, like each individual citizen. And honestly, this election was exhausting for me in that capacity, because on the left and the right, people were just sharing bullshit after bullshit after bullshit. Like, it was, and it was so disheartening with seeing it on the left. Like, I'm used to it on the right. Do you know what I mean? But like I'm used to, like, I had conversations with people on the right where I was literally like, hey, I just fact checked this for you. This is wrong. They're like, I don't have time to fact check everything that I share. And I'm like, I don't know where to go with this conversation then. But it's like, so you just are, and actually literally the rationale was because it supports how I feel already. So, and I'm like, but then maybe the reason you feel the way you feel is because of fake things. But, you know, it's very hard to...
No, you're wrong.
To go with that. Yeah, no, you're wrong. But then on the left,
I think it harpers back to our conversation before, Tyler. You're right. It's like that cyclical media cycle where it reinforces those beliefs. And you can just read whatever you want to reinforce that.
I'm not saying like I'm the... Yeah. No, I agree. I'm not saying
it happens to people on both sides, you know.
Yeah. That's a
good point that you make. I think that besides supporting print journalism and journalists that do really good work, I would support everybody to read The Atlantic, read The Washington and New York Times, The Washington Post, New York Times. But try to take media in from both sides.
yeah.
you see a story.
Yeah, for sure. Like the National Review yeah. or The Economist, both are fairly conservative.
Yeah. I mean, shit, like read Fox News and then once in a while when you work yourself up to it, go to Breitbart. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I mean, you have to. But like, it's just like, I'm not saying like I'm good, but like, here's a few pro tips. Like, don't like an article on Facebook unless you read it. You know what I mean? Like, I never, like, it bumps it up. Do you know what I mean? It bumps it up. If you yeah. don't, like, well, number one, first thing I ever do when I open an article, look at when it was published. I mean, people are like, Bernie Sanders, like, after the election, they're like, see, Bernie Sanders would have won. I'm like, well, this was, like, actually published a month before the election, and it was based on a poll that was in, like, July. So, but people, like, you know, and it's like, where people are like, look at all this Bernie rally, like, it wasn't on the mainstream, like, news media, and people, like, share, like, the meme, and then it's like, oh, here's an article about how actually it was on CNN, MSNBC. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like
4 months ago.
Yeah, and, like, we have a responsibility to do that, and, yeah, what I see on the right or the left is, like, I think we're flooded with so much information that people, like, are just like, oh, I gotta take it all in, you know, and they don't go farther than like headlines or like the little blurb at the top. And it's like, just, it sucks, everybody, but if we all just buckle down and just choose like one article you're gonna read today, you know, or two or three, depending on how much time you have, you know, instead of like 12 or 50 headlines, right? I think that's really important. Like, just, that's a responsibility we all have.
Sure.
It's a responsibility we all yeah. have to each other. I think that one of the things that, well, there are a lot of things that really disturbed me about this election, but one of the things that really disturbed me was, it was just personally really frustrating, was my inability to just articulate facts to people. To just be like, look, here is a thing that we should all agree on. And it was, I could not be effective at that. And people would just be like, well, look, like, the New York Times is bullshit. And I would be like, no, like, this is just a factual piece of information. And people would not believe those little things that we used to all agree on. And I do not know how to solve for that problem. But I think that is something that we have to solve. We have to figure out as a society, or we're in a lot of trouble. This is where journalism comes in, because we need people who can spend full time, 40 hours a week on this stuff, right? Like, these things are, it is hard to understand the truth, but people can come out, spend a lot of time on it, and at least throw down something that they can be proud of that's close to truth.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think it is really, really important that we monetarily support print journalists. Subscribe to your local newspaper, Denver Post. I tried. Fix your fucking website. Washington Post, New York Times. You know, Wikipedia.
Yeah, Vice
is doing a fundraiser right now. If we're not able to agree on a set of some sort of reality as a society, we lose like iPhones. Because if we can't agree on truth, we can't agree on science. And if we can't agree on science, we can't agree on technology. And I think that everybody can agree that that would piss them off.
I think also too, it would be almost, well, definitely easier if you can't contribute monetarily to journalism. You can do these two things as well. If you're not already, and if you're listening to this podcast, I kind of assume you are already, but, you know, listen to more of those journalists, and it, like you guys were saying, expose yourself to those different mediums, but also tell your friends to do that and suggest good articles or journalists that you like, or maybe sources that you find reputable, to those friends of yours, and help, you know, show them the way to good journalism and to good factual media and news.
Yeah.
Don't perpetuate the bullshit, I guess.
I mean, people trust who they trust, right? So that's how they did a study on getting people to register to vote, and turns out the best way to get people to register to vote is that someone in their life that they trust asks them to do it. And so I think that we all, again, going back to the office of citizen, we have the responsibility for each other to advocate to what we believe to be the truth. And honestly, we should do that fervently, but with a lot of empathy.
I just want to touch on, just to like kind of bring it back, like to like grounding in this moment, because we've mentioned some of the ways in which Trump and Trump administration is threatening the freedom of the press. But I just want to give one really direct example, which is Peter Thiel being appointed to the transition team. Peter Thiel, Gawker, which, think what you want about them as a news site. I mean, they also are like, you know, flippant, and they published a range of stuff from like actual good journalism to like just there's some yellow journalism going on for sure. But yeah, so whenever you think of them, they published something about him that he didn't like, but actually was true. It was horrible what they did. Then he bankrolled, lost. He sued them for defamation, lost because it was true, right? Because defamation is something that's not true, but it was true. And then he bankrolled for years. He bankrolled lawsuits against them until they went bankrupt. And that is basically just being like, oh, I don't like your media outlet. I have a shit ton of fucking money, and just throwing money at it until it goes away. And he's been appointed to the transition team of Trump. That's a very real thing that is there, right? Someone who has done it, who knows how to do it, who has gone through it, is now has the ear of the president-elect. So, you know, these we're talking about freedom of the press, and if you think it's just like kind of, oh, you know, he said some things, but, you know, blah. I mean, this is a pretty, like, real thing. If he wants to act on it, he's got someone with the expertise right there.
Yeah. Yep, and that's how you can go after America, or journalism in America today. You can make it too expensive.
Yep.
And this is one of the reasons why it's really important to give money, especially to national organizations like the New York Times and the Washington Post, because I can guarantee you they were going to be fighting a lot of lawsuits over the next 4 years, and they're going to need money in the bank to go and fight those. So it looks like we're coming up on time here, gentlemen. Does anybody have any parting remarks?
My next album will be called Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III.
We might have to play a couple songs. Yeah.
Well, I guess I will just say as parting words that I am grateful for Trump for the opportunity to highlight all of the things that I really care about, because he gives a pretty good foil to that. So Thanksgiving was not too long ago, and I would like to say I'm thankful for Trump, because now we are able to have such fantastic discussions like this with
Trump. You know, this podcast actually made me realize something too, John, that I hadn't really thought about until we sat down tonight. But, you know, also what I guess I might be thankful for a Trump presidency would be this is making me realize just how important, and this is always something that, you know, my mother taught me, right? But it's becoming that much more meaningful to me now. But treat others the way you want to be treated. And we do need to look inside ourselves and make those conscious moral decisions of whether something is right or wrong. And that goes for, you know, whatever, helping somebody, old lady across the street, you know, the traffic won't stop at the cross sign, or to, you know, posting bad information on your
Facebook.
Making sure an
immigrant feels welcome, or anyone.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah. Just showing your appreciation, in general.
It's a beautiful sentiment. Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful sentiment. And I just want to say I am not thankful for Trump. Sorry. I'm just being authentic right now. I'm really not. I was like, how can I?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Fuck Trump, right? This is the freedom of speech podcast. Fuck Trump, for sure.
Yeah, agreed. Fuck Trump.